It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's Food Friday. A Ukrainian-American chef joins us to share delicious recipes and the importance of the kitchen in Ukrainian culture. First, I'm in my 50s, and the thing is, I've sort of always felt like I was in my 50s, and I just kind of grew into that age. Well, apparently, I am a statistical outlier. Researchers have found that, on average, people over 40 see themselves as 20% younger than they actually are. So 50-year-olds think of themselves as 40, a 65-year-old maybe is 52. This concept of how old you are in your mind is called subjective age, and it's not always in line with our actual calendar age. We're talking about age and why we often feel younger than we actually are. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel your age? Have you always felt that? Do you feel like you are younger than the calendar claims you are? If we ask you, how old do you feel? What is the number you would share? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of the forthcoming On Grief, Love, Loss, and Memory, which won the 2022 Pulitzer Prize when it was first published in the magazine. She recently wrote about this idea of subjective age and why it's often different than our real age. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh my God, it's so nice to be here. How are you?
Good. Well, you went looking for research on this idea of subjective age. There's not a ton of it, but you did find some. Tell us what researchers have found.
I did find some. And, you know, here there is a lot of research if you're just looking in the field of gerontology. Like, people have been asking since the 70s, how old do you feel? And to me, this is like a boring question because lo and behold, if you feel younger than you are, you're probably in pretty good health and you probably are going to, you know, live longer. This to me is, you know, one of these dispatches from the Department of the Extraordinarily Obvious, like, duh, right? I was interested in the question of how old are you in your head? Mm-hmm. Like, how old do you perceive yourself to be mentally? And you're absolutely right. There's a lot less about that out there. The most interesting study that I found, the one with the most sort of inspired way of framing the question, which was how old are you in your head? It was nicely designed. It had a big sample size. It had like 1,000 people in it. And it found that, yeah, if you are north of 40, odds are statistically, you are going to think of yourself as 20% younger than you are. But here's what was also interesting. If you're younger than 25, you're going to think of yourself as older, which sort of makes sense intuitively to me from both directions. Apparently this made no sense to you. For what it's worth, it made no sense to my husband either, who looked at me as I was writing this and like kept crossing his eyes and saying, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, no, that's why anyway. This is so fascinating to me, because I don't, like, if you threw that question at me, I would, like, I guess I feel my age, but so many people, I think you included, and a lot of people you just threw that question at, they instantly respond with a number that's lower than their calendar age, right?
And lower than 20%. Like, I was surprised. I mean, when I speak to people, just my informal, you know, N of 100 or whatever, I mean, it's way lower. You know, I was by no means weird as a 53-year-old seeing myself as a 36-year-old. Like, that was pretty consistent. And once I wrote this piece and the cascade began on Twitter, it had this like unusually viral life, this piece. People were giving me all kinds of really young ages that did not correspond, frankly, with the 20% shave off. It was much closer to 30 and 40. And oh, by the way, if I can just say, mm-hmm. one of the most common answers that I got on Twitter that I think speaks to this, and which would suggest that it's a lot less than or a lot more than 20%. I can't tell you how many people wrote to me and said that, like, they would drop off their mother at assisted living and their mother would look at them and say, mm-hmm. please don't make me stay here. It's filled with old people.
Yeah, I remember my grandma complaining about all the senior citizens, you know, in her mid 70s.
There you go.
Yeah. Now,
and what was she? I mean, right.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't know the age she thought she was, but it wasn't her actual age. That's for sure. Now, right. What do we know about why? Why do we do this?
Okay. So I'm glad that you asked. I find the answers that social science gives incredibly unsatisfying. which is not surprising. I think you really need like novelists to answer some of the most interesting questions, you know, that kind of come out of these lines of inquiry. I mean, they all gave answers like, it's ageism, right? It's internalized ageism that Americans and Westerners just consider aging a catastrophe. And we have some, and there's some evidence for this. I mean, because when you look at the cross-cultural studies, people in Asia and people in Africa shave less, shave fewer years off of their age. So on the one hand, maybe there's something to that, because in Asia and in Africa, there's more respect for the elderly. There's, you know, in Japan, there's like respect for the aged day. There's all kinds of things, you know. So yeah, I get that. But I think that there are a number of things. And I think one of them is that, first of all, it could be seen as a form of optimism that we think of ourselves as having, you know, one or two or three pivots left in us. So we don't think of ourselves as being the age that we are, you know. I think that some of it is that the older you get, you know, the smaller, a year is increasingly a smaller and smaller percentage or fraction of your life. So you're more inclined to maybe identify with an age where a year felt longer to you. I think that's a distinct possibility. I think also people identify with the age that they were sort of in a professional or personal sweet spot. That seems to happen a lot, where it's sort of their potential and their competence were in perfect equipoise. That seems to be a very common answer. So like for me, 36 was an age where I was still brimming with potential. I knew what the contours of my life looked like, but they hadn't been filled in yet, you know? So I think that's some of it. What are other answers? We spent a lot more time being younger than we did being older.
That's fair.
It's just like a raw numerical response, I mean, I guess.
Talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about a piece she wrote about subjective age, the idea that the age we are in our heads doesn't always match up with what the calendar says. Love to hear your answer to these questions at 800-642-1234. If I ask you, how old are you in your head? Is it the same as your age, like it is pretty much for me, or is it different, like it is for, I guess, most people? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Sun Prairie. Mike, hello.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about?
It applies to me, and I think there's probably a segment that it applies to, you know, in the population is, I have three children, but I started later. I had my first child when I was 38. And I think, you know, the saying kids keep you young would be a big part of why I consider myself at least 8 years younger than I really am. And I think there's data out that says people are having kids later in life. And that may just be one possible reason that, you know, your kids force you to stay younger, at least mentally.
I am so glad. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Jennifer, go ahead.
No, I'm so glad he said that. Mike is absolutely right. And I forgot to say that a lot of this is that we are deferring some of the things that our parents' generation did younger. And so that is exactly right. And I think that we have in our heads, and Mike probably has in his head, and by the way, I was also 38 when my kid was born, 37 when I got pregnant. I think we have in our heads an image of what 50 looks like or 40 looks like based on our parents. And also, you know, a generation ago or whatever, people smoked. They didn't have the same like skincare products. Their diets were worse. They did sort of in some ways look older in addition to sort of starting earlier. Somebody blew my doors off by recently pointing out to me that Carol O'Connor and Jean Stapleton and All of the Family, you know, when they were playing, you know, Archie Bunker and Edith, they were in their 40s. I mean, if you held a gun to my head, I would have said they were in their
60s. 50s, 60s, I would have guessed. 50s, yeah.
60s. Yeah, right.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. I appreciate it. We're talking to staff writer Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic about her article on subjective age, the age you are in your head versus your actual calendar chronological age, and why those two numbers often don't match up for a lot of people. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that where in your head you are younger than the number that, you know, is on the calendar, or maybe older. That is true, especially for younger people. If you're in the middle, I don't know. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Jennifer Senior, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at her recent piece headlined, "I'm 56 year old, I'm 36 in my head." We're talking about why it is that a lot of people feel younger, their mental self-image is younger than their actual age. And you can join in with your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Eau Claire. Scott, hi.
Hi. My comment is, you know, I look at all these younger people around me and I just feel like, you know, I look at them, the way the shape they're in, and everybody complains about working. I've been working 70-hour weeks pretty much since I've been a teenager. And to this day, I still work those hours, and they complain. And I think most of it's like the feeling of a work ethic and keeping in shape and just not being lazy. Everybody nowadays, these kids want to play video games. They want to do this. They want to do that. Nobody wants to work anymore. It's just like
I want to hear some numbers from you, Scott. Your age versus how old you feel, or how old your self-image is.
I'm 56, and I feel like I'm 35 or younger.
Excellent, Scott. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, Jennifer, we heard Scott's numbers. He chalks it up to, I think, some of his attitudes and his approach to life there.
Yeah, I'm disinclined to actually say that it's because people have different work ethics. I think I would just have to respectfully disagree with him. I mean, I think that, you know, how old we are in our heads is sort of a function perhaps of how many good years we feel like we have left as productive workers. You know, I mean, I still feel like I could keep writing for the next 25 years if somebody wanted, you know, that's how I feel now anyway. And, you know, we've got like an 80-year-old president. We had until recently a speaker who was in her 80s. You know, I mean, There are examples of this all over American life of people who lead, you know, who lead constructive lives and until, you know, right through their 80s, you know, as octogenarians. By the way, just one quick thing. Mm-hmm. Did you say I was 56? Because you don't need to rush me. I'm 53.
53. Okay. I think we got a typo in the headline there. 53 years old, 36 in
there. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in, Scott. I appreciate it. We'll go back to your call. Louise is with us in Dodgeville. Louise, hi.
Hi. I went back to college later in life, and I just always had this, like, funny experience on campus, like, you know, I'd be walking between classes and I'd have my backpack on, you know, and it's sunny out and I'm like walking along and I'm like, I'm 20 again, I'm 20. And then I'd be like, I'd catch myself like in the window reflection and I'd be like, oh my God, I do not look like I'm a 20-year-old walking around campus. But it's like funny.
I love it, Louise.
Funny how you get caught up in that, you know, or like, your mind's eye versus, you know, the physical reality.
Louise, thank you so much. That's a great story. And Jennifer, reminds me, I think in your piece you talk about this is common
where,
you know, a 50-year-old is talking to younger folks and thinking they're one of them, and they lose that consciousness of that age difference.
I'm so glad she brought that up. Yeah, it was a great comment because exactly. A friend, so it's not a friend, it's somebody I really respect in our business who's a social scientist, and his name is Ian Leslie. He wrote to me privately and he said this on Twitter. And he said, I totally feel like I'm, you know, I'm 51 in plain old reality, but I also think of myself as being in my 30s. And whenever I'm talking to people in their 30s, I make the mistake of thinking I'm the same age as them. And I thought, oh my God, I have done that so many times in my life to the point that like, I will start, just as this woman said, Louise, I think her name was, like, you know, thinking she's 20, blah, blah, blah. I'll think the exact same thing. And then somebody who is in their 30s will say something to me that will make me feel like I may as well be Dame Judi Dench or Maggie Smith, that I might as well be like a dowager from Downton Abbey, you know, and you realize, oh my God, they think that there is just this distance between us that can be measured in light years. You know, it's just crazy. So it's always very humbling when that happens.
Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Louise. I appreciate it. Judy joins us now in Franklin. Judy, hello.
Good afternoon to everyone. I am in my 70s, but I remember when I was much younger, when we went shopping, and I'm thinking more female than male, there were places in the store that were set for older ladies. Their shoes were different. Their hats were different. Everything was different. And now, any woman going into a store, you go by brand or by size, but it doesn't necessarily set you with an age. And I think that may change how we reflect on age or how we see each other.
What an interesting observation, Judy. Thanks for that. What do you think, Jennifer?
I think it's a great, great point. And it goes to that point that I was saying earlier about, like, you know, I've got unguents that make my skin look younger. I don't smoke. None of us smoke. You know, I dress like my teenager dresses. I wear the same, you know, t-shirts and lucky jeans. You know, I mean, like, it's absolutely, she's absolutely right. I think that a lot of these distinctions have collapsed so that there's little reason. And again, and also we're deferring doing a lot of things that, you know, our parents did in their 20s. We're doing them in our 30s. So we've held over whatever our youthful selves were, and our clothing and our music and our, in all these ways. I think it's true. I think she's right.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Jennifer Senior from The Atlantic. She wrote about subjective age, how old we are in our heads versus by the clock and the calendar. Before we go back to our callers, I wanted to get this. You reached out to Margaret Atwood, the author, now in her 80s, about her thoughts on this. Can you share some of her response with us?
Yeah, it was delightful. It was very typically her. I mean, she was sort of saying, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm 83 and I kind of like being 83. And, you know, when you're 53, when you're your age, you're sort of self-conscious about how much older you are than other people and whether people are going to think of you as old. But by the time you're my age, you really are old. So the pressure's off. And she said, so, you know, I time travel in my head every now and then and revisit the decades that I liked, but I actually enjoy being old. And I actually, you know, take pleasure in it, and I make old jokes, and you'll see that in some ways it's better than being 53. There are advantages to being old. And I think she's sort of symbolic of the work of a woman named Becca Levy, who's an epidemiologist up at Yale, who has shown that if you have a very positive attitude toward aging, you also age well. And I think that Becca Levy's work has in common with the body of literature that says its opposite, which is that if you think of yourself as young, you also age well. What they have in common is that in both instances, you see yourself as being useful. Mm-hmm. Whether you think you have a positive attitude toward aging and you're like, hey, I like being in my 80s. I've got wisdom. I've got this. I've got that. I've got stuff to contribute. Or whether you're, you know, younger and think of yourself as even younger, you think, I have stuff to contribute. It's the same thought. And I think that that's what ties them together.
Let's go back to our callers. Nancy is with us now in Ironwood. Nancy, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. What's your story, Nancy?
Well, I have a question. My husband is 65, but when he's talking about work, he's talking about how young he is and how he feels so great. And then we'll say something. The kids will say, hey, Dad, let's go snowmobiling, or let's go here and there. And oh, no, I'm just too old for that. I'm 65. I don't get why he goes both ways.
Interesting, Nancy. Thanks a lot for that. Yeah, I don't know. I like what he's doing. He's using it strategically. He doesn't want to go snowmobiling, and he'll use that as his excuse.
Total. It's like selective hearing. I think it is consistent with something else that people have said to me, which is that if it will depend on the day or the minute or the hour, you know, if you ask them how old they are in their head. So it could be true that Nancy's husband feels young, you know, at the office, or I don't know if he's at an office, wherever he's working, you know. It might not be an office, but if he's asked to go snowmobiling, suddenly he's thinking, oh, I don't want to, like, you know, on the off chance that we run over a branch and I mm-hmm. get tossed out, I don't want to break anything. You know, I mean, I can feel incredibly young, and then my knees will tell me something different, you know. I mean, it just depends.
Thanks for the call, Nancy. Time for one more caller. Janet is with us on the road. Janet, hi.
Hello, and she just mentioned her knees. So let me explain that I love this topic, and now you're giving a term subjective age to what I've been calling my emotional age. But I'm turning 71 next month. I think that's kind of funny. We have our chronological age. We have our what you're calling subjective age, where, as I'm saying, my emotions are, and I feel like a kid. I work with many people of ages at a seasonal job, and so I do speak to people about this, and they seem to like the topic of how old the sage is in our life. So our subjective age, and I think I'm in my 30s, 40s. But then you mentioned your knees, and that's the third one I usually add because it's how old our body is. And I've had so many surgeries, and I've had replacements, but it doesn't stop me from my subjective age of 30s and 40s.
Janet, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Jennifer, that takes us, I think, to a good point to wrap up with. I don't know, how can we embrace the best of our emotional age, as Janet says, or our subjective age?
I mean, I think that they're not incompatible, right? I mean, that's what I would say. But I think that it's true. Your knees are going to, and your hips or whatever, are going to tell you one story one day. But it's possible you're keeping your knees young by, you know, by having a different age in your head. It's hard to know, right? But I like her line about how she thinks that turning 71 is funny, because people do say to me that they look in the mirror and they just think that they've seen a system error, that there's just some kind of mistake. So I very much appreciated that aspect of her comment too.
Thanks for the call, Janet. And Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Jennifer Senior is a staff writer at The Atlantic, author of the book On Grief. She recently wrote about subjective age and why the age in our mind is often lower than our real age, especially when we're over 50. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday as Chef shares delicious Ukrainian recipes and a celebration of Ukrainian culture. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, should older, potentially offensive books be revised to remain relevant or left alone in favor of fresher works? We'll talk to a historian and former teacher about new revised editions of books by Roald Dahl and Ian Fleming. Think James and the Giant Peach and James Bond. Now, what's the secret to a good borscht or awesome dumplings? It's Food Friday, and our guest today is sharing some of the recipes that she grew up with in Ukraine. Her new cookbook has turned into a cause. She's sharing a celebration of Ukrainian culture while raising funds to help feed people living through the war. Our next guest says, in Ukraine, life happens in the kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Ukrainian cuisine? What are some of your favorite foods from Eastern Europe? Did you grow up eating Ukrainian food? Love to hear your favorites, your stories at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Voloshina is a Ukrainian-American chef and author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us, Budmo, what does that mean in English?
So budmo, it translates to let us be, but we use it as cheers. So it's a very cheerful word. And when we drink something, we always say budmo. And that means let us be together, let us enjoy this moment, and let us celebrate life.
What made you decide to write this cookbook and share these recipes, many of which you grew up with?
So first of all, there are not a lot of Ukrainian cookbooks. And I saw that when people were eating my food, they were like, oh, my God, I would totally cook it at home. And I thought, maybe I need to write a book. And my publisher was thrilled with the idea, and they said, go for it. I wrote it, and I wanted to write a book about the other way of living, the other way of eating, something I grew up, and Ukrainian relationships to food and to culinary culture. So it's just something different, and I think that the United States were ready for this.
And before we get to the food itself, can you talk about how you're hoping to use your work and Ukrainian food to support people in Ukraine during this invasion?
Of course. So when the war started, the first day, I got hundreds of messages from our local community, from chefs and food writers and culinary instructors, and they said, how can we help? And we decided hosting classes and pop-ups and dinners and fundraisers, whatever we could do. We just cook for people, and they bought tickets or they just send us donations, and we raised a ton of money. And then my publisher, like, I think it was the first week of war, and they called me and like, okay, you're doing a fundraiser for World Central Kitchen. We want to do something as well. Let's start pre-sailing the book. It's not ready yet. It's like still a few months to go, but let's start the pre-sale, and we will donate 20% from all the pre-sales to World Central Kitchen. And then our local bookstore contacted me, and they said, okay, we want to start pre-saving as well, and we will donate money to this lovely lady who owns a cookbook store in Ukraine, and she helps Ukrainian people, so we'll send money to her. And that's just like the whole community came together and stand with Ukraine, and it was such a magical moment for me, because it was such a dark time, but people and from the culinary world and all over the place, from the United States, they just made it so much easier for me, and they helped so much.
Now, turning to the book, Budmo, one thing I love about it is I think Ukrainian weather must be kind of like we have in Wisconsin, and agriculture is similar. A lot of the ingredients in Ukraine you could find pretty easily here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about some of the, I don't know, the distinctive features of Ukrainian cooking, the distinctive ingredients in particular?
Absolutely. So, of course, Ukraine has all four seasons. So we are very close to our land, so we follow the seasons. We preserve food in summer to have something exciting to eat in winter. And I grew up that way, so I grew up knowing where my food is coming from. And, of course, we had a small vegetable garden and a small food garden because we had a house, and my grandma had a house, not an apartment. And everybody in Ukraine owns a little bit of their own land. Or if they don't, they just go to the farmer's market, which is bazaar, and they buy everything locally. And specifically our region, which is the south of Ukraine, is famous for the watermelons and melons, and I think the best tomatoes in the whole world. I just love them. And our ingredients are very, very understandable. We don't have like this exotic fruits. We don't have a lot of spices, and we don't have a lot of hot peppers. So everything is very familiar to the American audience because we, of course, grow a lot of similar things and potato that come from the United States. We just love it so much. We didn't have it in the 18th century, even in 19th century, but now it's such a central part of our cuisine. So I wanted to write a book where anyone can cook from, no matter the place, no matter the country, no matter the city. Everybody can go to a grocery store, get all the ingredients, and just start cooking from the book.
Anna Voloshina is with us on this edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest about Ukrainian recipes, foods, ingredients, and culture. If you have a favorite dish from the Ukrainian cuisine to share with us, you could tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When we think about that region of the world, Anna, we might think about borscht, which it turns out comes in a lot of different colors and flavors. Can you tell us what is it that makes something borscht?
Okay, so borscht, despite like a lot of people might think borscht is all about beets, but it was not like that 300 years ago. Borscht is something very sour. The key component is the sour component. So in green borscht, it's actually sorrel, so it plays the main role. So something that has this wonderful combination of tangy and sweet, and it's very comforting, and it's kind of in between a stew and a soup. That's what borscht is. But now Ukrainian borscht, which we all know and love these days, it's mainly this very rich and luxurious soup with beets and tons of vegetables. And personally, I love it vegetarian, but my husband will disagree with me. He loves it with pork ribs. And you cannot define borscht in one sentence even. It's the whole culture. It's such an important dish for Ukrainian cuisine. We have songs about borscht. We have books about borscht and tales and poems. And every family in Ukraine will cook their own version of borscht. And I guarantee if you will go from one family to another, you will not taste two borscht that are alike.
We've got a recipe for that green sorrel borscht that Anna was talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Green sorrel, a springtime ingredient you can find if you look for it here in Wisconsin, often at farmers markets. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brielle is with us in McFarland. Brielle, hi.
Hi.
You've got a question, I understand. What did you want to ask Anna?
My question is, what do kids love to eat in Ukraine?
Oh, interesting question. What is kid food for Ukrainian kids, Anna?
Oh, my God. I love this question. So my favorite food was, of course, Ukrainian vareniki, which you might know under another name, pierogi. So this is, I could eat every day, all day. They are the cutest little dumplings shaped as half moons. And they stuffed with a bunch of different stuff, so they can be sweet, they can be savory, and it was a whole ritual in our house to make those. And I remember when I was little, my job was to arrange those dumplings in a perfect rows, and then my grandma would just slide the cutting board with dumplings into her freezer. She would freeze them solid, and then any day I would ask for dumplings, she would just boil them from this frozen pieces, and they would taste exactly the same as fresh ones. And one of the favorite stuffings that all kids like are sour cherries. They are just amazing.
Brielle, thank you so much for calling in. You mentioned those dumplings. I grew up eating pierogi that my Polish grandma made. Is there a difference between those, that Polish version, and it's the varenki? In Ukrainian, is there something that says, yeah, that's a pierogi, this is the Ukrainian style?
Yes, one tiny, tiny difference. They're basically twin brothers, but the only difference is we rarely fry our vareniki. So vareniki, the name comes from the word varity, which means to boil. So they're basically boiled, and then when we are done enjoying them and the next day we want to reheat them, we will refry them on a pan. So this is it. I think this is the only difference. But the closer you go in Ukraine to the Polish border, the more you will hear the name pierogi versus vareniki, and the more you will see them fried versus boiled. So I listened to one Polish culinary historian, and he said, we cannot say for sure who came up with those dumplings. We cannot say it's Polish. We cannot say it's 100% Ukrainian. So we just share this dish, and we are happy to share because Poland is such a great friend of Ukraine.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Anna Voloshina, Ukrainian-American chef, author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. We're talking about Ukrainian cuisine, its importance in Ukrainian culture. You'll find a few of the recipes we talk about today online at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What Ukrainian dishes have you encountered, maybe tried to cook yourself? Do you have questions about what goes into Ukrainian cooking? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Anna Voloshina about her cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. She's sharing recipes that have been passed down in her family and other dishes central to Ukrainian life. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, your experiences eating, maybe making Ukrainian food, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Go back to your calls. Heather is with us in Brookfield. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about or bring up?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say just I used to live in Ukraine, and I was so amazed by how connected the cuisine was to the earth. And that was mentioned already, but it was just amazing the amount of produce during the summer and through fall. It was so delicious, the tomatoes and the cucumbers and lots of dill. just wonderful flavors. And I just wish I could replicate that here in the States. I love the dachas, and just there's so much produce, and the melons were delicious too. One question I had, I was visiting with a woman in Kiev, and it was in October, and she pulled out of her oven a pumpkin with almost like a rice casserole inside of it. And then she would kind of stir it up a little bit to get the meat of the pumpkin mixed with the rice. And I've tried to replicate that, and I could never get it.
So it was actually cooked in the pumpkin itself. The pumpkin itself is the vessel. Interesting, Heather. Anna, have you run into that?
Oh, my God, yes. It is one of my favorite fall dishes. So first of all, in my book, I have a recipe for pumpkin kasha. Mm-hmm. Despite common opinion, kasha is not buckwheat. Kasha is just the name of a dish. It's like soup and kasha can be with rice. So I have the recipe with pumpkin kasha, but I also made another kasha with not with rice, but with millet. And it's like more traditional in Ukraine inside a pumpkin. So you can totally make it happen. You just need to make sure you roast it in a low oven. You need to soak your rice overnight and then use the best full fat milk, a little bit of raisins, vanilla, and this is it. And you basically stir it all together, stuff it inside the pumpkin, and roast it in a 300 oven for a couple of hours, maybe up to 3 hours. And then once you are able to pierce the pumpkin with a knife, this is it. This is ready, and taste your rice. It needs to be cooked through, but in 3 hours it will be cooked. And then you just mix the flesh and the kasha together, and it will be the most luxurious dish you've ever made.
Heather, thanks for the call. Now you just have to wait for pumpkin season. Anna, I would guess that we're going to be best off using a smaller, like, baking pumpkin as opposed to our giant Halloween pumpkins.
Oh, yeah. Oh yes, for sure. Yes. Try to find the one that is actually has a lot of flavor. So some sugar pumpkins, small pumpkins, just make two or three, but the smaller will cook faster.
Thanks again for that call, Heather. Susan is with us now in Milwaukee. Susan, hello.
Hello there.
What did you want to tell us about?
I am delighted to hear her, and I'm hoping that my cousin and his wife might possibly be listening. I know that they are also fans of public radio. In the midst of the COVID, my 99-year-old aunt died of COVID, based on neglect of people who were working around her, not wearing masks, not being vaccinated in the central part of Wisconsin. But there stood this big old house, the family house on the farm, and my cousin and his wife still live on the farm, and they just have moved heaven and earth and were determined to find a family from Ukraine to move here and to live in that home. And so they did a GoFundMe, and they have them, it's a man and wife and two children, and the last I heard, they were getting the children enrolled in school and in preschool, and they're taking English lessons, and they're getting jobs, and the thing with is American food, and of course, my cousin and his wife are enjoying Ukrainian food as well. I just thought that.
Wonderful. Susan, thank you so much for sharing that with us. Were there, you know, in that position, Anna, were there adaptations you had to make in the U.S. to, you know, what you used to be able to cook in Ukraine?
Oh, absolutely. When I came here, I didn't know anything, of course. And my husband's co-workers, they decided to show us everything. And they brought us to Safeway. And I almost left crying because I saw those pale tomatoes. And the food cost was so high and the produce was not good. And I thought, okay, this is it. This is my life now. And then the next week, I discovered a farmer's market, which was just a couple of blocks away from the place we lived. And it was the most joyous moment because the produce there was so amazing. And I feel like this is the main problem, is to find good produce. And I feel like we are very spoiled in the Bay Area because we have everything there and the quality is superb. And it very much reminds me of the produce in Ukraine. So the only thing is, like, I had to start like being very conscious with my choices. And then I started making my own sour cream and my own cheese at home. Everything that we use in Ukrainian cooking, and the quality here is not the same, or I cannot find the produce. I would just make it myself. I make my own kefir. I make basically everything dairy I can transform into some product from Ukraine. And other than that, I don't miss anything because we have amazing bread in San Francisco. And just took time to learn everything and to find my farmers.
We are talking to Anna Voloshina, Ukrainian-American chef. Her new cookbook is called Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. We heard from Joan in Racine, who says her ancestors are from Crimea. Joan's mom used to make a fresh green bean soup with bacon, vinegar, and potatoes in the summer. And Joan wants to know if that's, you know, from Crimea or Ukraine or elsewhere. I know sometimes, Anna, like with the pierogies, it can be hard to tell where they started from.
Oh, with this one, it's definitely not Ukrainian. I would say this is Tatar, because Crimean population was very much consisting of Tatars before USSR moved them to Siberia. And then they were, after the USSR collapsed, they were able to come back to Crimea, to Ukraine, and they brought their dishes with them. So this is not 100% Ukrainian dish. I think it's mostly Tatar / Turkish Greek influence. And we love it in Ukraine, but I wouldn't say we own this recipe.
And that reminds me, you refer to yourself as a recipe detective. Could you tell us a little bit about your investigations to try to find different recipes and their origins?
Yes, because right now, especially after the war, Ukraine wants to rediscover its culinary identity, because for 70 plus years since the Soviet Union dragged us into that whole story, we almost lost our culinary culture, because the goal of USSR was to make every republic identical. And they tried to erase the identity of other nations by erasing their recipes and their dishes and forming this one blend cuisine with different dishes from all over the world. And we lost a lot of our history. We lost a lot of our books, and we were not allowed to write cookbooks in Ukrainian. So right now, a lot of chefs and a lot of culinary writers, they are digging very deep to discover what was an actual Ukrainian cuisine before the USSR and before it was heavily influenced by that nonsense.
Anna, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course. Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That's Anna Voloshina, author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. She joined us on Food Friday to share flavors from her native country, as well as recipes you'll find in her new cookbook. And we've got a few of them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. We mentioned that green sorrel borscht. We've also got, these look great, beet pickled deviled eggs. a beautiful color too from those beets, and grandma's roasted duck, something to celebrate with. Find those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. You can keep sharing your own experiences maybe with Ukrainian food on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, check out the latest sleep research, find out how we can get better sleep, that's very useful, and why it's so good for our health to get good rest on a regular basis. Join that conversation. It's coming up Monday morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. A few weeks back on Food Friday, we talked about cooking with citrus. And I mentioned we don't have a lot of locally sourced citrus here in Wisconsin. I was mostly right, but I should have known I wasn't completely right. I just saw an article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about growing lime and lemon trees here in Wisconsin. You might have guessed the secret. You can grow them in pots, keep them outside when it's warm enough, bring them inside for the winter. It's not easy, but you could do it. And I should have known you can do it, because that same article mentions a well-known lime tree here in Wisconsin. The tree is named Limey, and it's raised by a guy named Larry Mueller. Yes, WPR's own Larry Mueller is a successful citrus farmer on a very small scale, and I've heard him talk about Limey on the air before. Now, Larry's a good gardener. I am not, so I think I'll keep getting my citrus in the produce aisle. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.